Chapter 34. I am relieved when Ron's car isn't in the staff parking lot at Sioux High School. If there's nothing to be found, I don't want him witnessing my disappointment and embarrassment. And if my hunch is correct, it means Uncle David wanted me to find it. After I read his research, I'll know whether he intended for me to share it with the FBI. Part of me wishes I could ask Jamie to come along. I want him to be with me whether there's a hidden notebook or not, but if it's there, Uncle David meant for me, and me alone, to read it. The secretary makes me sign in even though it's the end of the school day. As I do, she asks about Grandmary and Mom. My grandmother is the same. Thank you for asking, Mrs. Hammond. A plausible lie comes to me in a flash. But my mom has been having a hard time lately. She's still grieving. I wondered if I could go to Uncle David's classroom. We left some of his things there, framed posters and stuff. It might help her to have them now. The day I boxed up his belongings, I had an odd mix of feelings. Devastating grief, surreal disbelief, a sliver of doubt as I replayed his inexplicably distracted behavior over the weeks and months prior to his disappearance. It was just enough to spark fury, and then, deep shame that I was angry at Uncle for abandoning me to hold Mom together without his help. Of course, dear. You go right ahead. I'll be here until 5. I sprint to the science classroom. Breathless, I sit at the desk that looked like a gray military tank. Mom was supposed to arrange for movers to haul it to the big house, but it was still in his classroom. 3 drawers on the left side, 2 on the other. The bottom right drawer was where he kept snacks for me so I could power through hockey practice. Sometimes Levi would stop by after school to mooch snacks for himself and the guys. Uncle David never minded. He would say, "Plenty for all. That's why I keep the biggest drawer full." I remember the 3rd day of Lily crossing over. The day for learning about new worlds. When Ron and his squeaky shoe brought me here. I'd pulled out the snack drawer, disappointed by the sight of file folders hiding the false metal bottom. Uncle David showed it to me only once. I was 10. He was so excited for his new job. The dissecting kits are across the classroom in the storage case next to the microscopes. He kept his more elaborate dissecting kit on the top shelf. I removed 2 identical tools from the zippered case. A Mall probe and seeker is a 6-inch chrome rod with an angled tip on one end. It's like a dental pick, but less delicate. I extend the bottom drawer fully and kneel next to it to begin my task. The folders are filed alphabetically, so I make neat stacks on the floor in order. My fingers touch the barely visible holes in each corner of the metal bottom, focusing on 2 corners diagonally across from each other. I slide the bent tips into the minuscule openings before straightening the tools. Heart pounding, I lift the probe's angled ends to hoist what resembles a metal lid covering a hidden bottom, 2 inches deep, and just a hair smaller than the width and length of the drawer. This could be it. The most important clue so far. I can't look. I have to. But what if... I look down to see an ordinary blue spiral notebook. There. It's right there. I knew it. Uncle David documented everything. I do know my uncle. I set the metal lid against the wall. It promptly slides and clangs loudly. "Donis, are you still here, dear?" Mrs. Hammond calls down the hallway. "Yup." I slide the notebook into the back of my jeans. Her footsteps approach as I quickly put the false bottom back into place and return the file folders. I nearly drop one stack. I close the drawer 3 seconds before she reaches the doorway. It's enough time for me to spot the probes on the floor. I sit back against the wall and cover the tools with my leg. "It's harder to be back here than I thought," I tell her. Channeling any bit of stealth, I scoop up the probes as I rise. Mrs. H takes a step closer, and I fear she might try to comfort me. I hold up my left hand to keep her at bay. "I'm fine," I say, sitting on the edge of the desk. I pretend to compose myself, which requires a stellar performance because I'm shaking for real. It's possible the secret that Uncle David took to his grave is in the notebook pressed against my sweaty back. My body provides cover to slide the probes into the dissecting kit and zip it shut. I glance around the room for anything that belonged to my uncle. I spy the shadow box with his collection of Lake Superior rocks and minerals. That was Uncle David's. I point to it before going over and carefully lifting it from its multiple picture hooks. This case and his dissecting kit on the desk are all that's left. Well, besides his desk. Thank you so much, Mrs. Hammond. I know my mother would want to have these. I'll make sure she arranges to move the desk during Christmas break. And I'll tell my mother you said hello. She offers to carry the kit for me, and I let her. I'm riding a wave of secret squirrel satisfaction, fueled by jittery nerves and the secret tucked against my back. We walk to the Jeep. I thank her again while loading the two items. She reaches to hug me. I pretend to misunderstand her movement, quickly clasping her hands in mine, a gently squeeze and a gesture of appreciation as if words fail me. Once your mother is feeling better, I hope you'll rethink staying home. I know Indian kids struggle in college because they're not prepared academically or socially, but Donis, you're not like them. Words truly do fail me. All I can do is gape at her in disbelief. Well, I don't mean anything bad about Indians, Mrs. Hammond looks around anxiously. You know I'm not prejudiced. As I attempt to put Mrs. Hammond's bigotry bingo out of my mind, I run through possible locations where I can read Uncle's notebook undisturbed. Definitely not home, because Mom will be there fixing dinner. Nothing on campus, because I know too many people. Same goes for coffee shops. Maybe the big house? Or what about Evercare? That's it. I'll sit with Grandmary and tell the nurses I'm studying. I send identical texts to Mom and Jamie. Me, studying for exam, shutting off phone, will be home late. Talk tomorrow. Walking down the hallway, I crack my back out of habit. The muscles in my neck and shoulders feel like guitar strings tightened one turn too many. I enter my grandmother's room to find Mom crying in the recliner next to an empty bed. What happened? My mouth is the only part of me that can move. The rest is numb with icy fear. Mom looks up, surprised. Grandmary's okay, she says, rising quickly. There's an issue with the plumbing. They needed to move some patients around. I study her, and she doesn't avoid my eyes. Hers are puffy and bloodshot from crying. Her face is open, unguarded, drained. Did you have a rough day? I ask gently. No, sweetheart. I had a good day. Grandmary, too. It just caught up with me. Next to the recliner, the blank notebook is on the bedside table. The closet is empty. She found it while moving things to the new room. I didn't mean to upset you with that, I say, collecting the notebook. When I shove it into the back of my jeans, I feel Uncle David's spiral notebook, Uncle David's secret. I know, she says. I really did have a good day. I ran into one of my students at the store. Such a happy little girl. Mom glows. It felt like a roller coaster when I looked through the notebook. She considers her words before asking, Do you ever have days where every different emotion seems to cling to you and it's just too much? As if to prove that I do, indeed, have those days, I smile and feel the pre-cry pinpricks in my nose. I'll leave the Jeep here and hop in your car. Let's rent a video and get takeout, I say, pleased when Mom nods happily. The two notebooks at my back will need to wait, because it's been one of those days. On Thursday, I finish my run, check on Grandmary in her new room, and drive the Jeep home. My day includes the usual. Shower, class, Granny June, ferry, Sugar Island, lunch, and listen to Granny June's tirade du jour. Today, she's mad at the Elders Book Club members. They shot down her James A. Mishner book suggestion. But what got Granny even more riled up was Sini Nimki saying, "If we read a story about Hawaii, I'd rather support native Hawaiian authors." As usual, Sini is spot on. I thought I'd be excited for my afternoon plans to pick up my outfit for Shagala and then go to the big house and read Uncle David's notebook. It's what I've been hoping for. Information that might help the investigation. My uncle's last communication. Instead, I take the scenic route back to Granny June's house. I offer to run errands with her. When she declines, I make my way to the dress boutique. Mrs. Edwards tries to rush me in and out, but I insist on letting others check out before me. All the while, a growing sense of dread builds until I find myself sitting in the Jeep with the engine shut off, parked in the garage at the big house. What if Uncle David's final thoughts reveal what happened to him? What if he was scared or hurt? What if his notebook raises more questions than it answers? What if? What if? What if? I shake my head. What if it helps someone? What if it could bring comfort to Mom? I repeat those two what-ifs as I make my way to the library and sit at Grandpa Lorenzo's desk in his leather chair. My entire body trembles. I stare at the blue notebook. Should I start at the last page? I run my hand across the back cover, tempted to jump into the deep end. No, I turn the notebook over to start where he started, in the before. I need to earn Uncle David's story. His first entry was on September 2, 2003, the first day of my senior year. My uncle wrote in English, mostly. Nearly every school day had an entry. He enjoyed jotting down the more intriguing questions asked by students, leaving room for follow-up notes, which were often in a different color of ink. Instead of students' names, he mostly used initials and a class period. A few students were assigned a symbol instead. I pick out mine right away. A heart. When Uncle David spoke in code with Mom about me, I was
Nakur.
The French word for heart, with the Anishinaabemowin N in front to make it possessive. My heart. My uncle loved me and trusted that I would find the clues he left for me. When my nose stings and my throat tightens, I decide not to fight what my body wants to do. I reach for tissues and let myself feel however I feel. He included ideas we discussed for my senior year science fair project. I forgot about my plan to compare resting heart rates before and after smudging with sage and sweetgrass. The goal was to identify whether there was a significant difference in Nishnabs who used traditional medicines compared with a control group of those who did not use the medicines. His side notes included reduced variables and Likert scale for cultural identity. We had a heated debate about trying to quantify cultural identity. I wasn't comfortable asking participants to assign a number value to something like, "How Nish are you?" Uncle David challenged me to come up with a research question that might work with a Likert rating scale. I believe smudging, a cultural practice of burning and breathing in smoke, with traditional medicines, such as Moshka Dewashk, sage, and Wingashk, sweetgrass, will improve my overall physical and mental well-being. Strongly agree? Agree. Neither agree nor disagree. Disagree. Strongly disagree. In the end, I didn't do any project my senior year. I was eating, breathing, and dreaming hockey at that point. When Uncle David didn't question my decision to opt out, I thought something about his behavior was odd. In October, Uncle David began writing more about one student in particular. Their symbol was a light bulb with a face, including a full smile like a watermelon slice. The student, light bulb, asked many clever questions. Brian Cheneau was known to the entire school as someone who always asked questions, but his questions didn't always end with an actual question mark. They were more like stream of consciousness exercises or monologues with a lengthy buildup that ended with, "Isn't that so?" which isn't an inquiry, but rather fishing for validation. Question: could Ryan Chenow be Lightbulb? Answer: no. Ryan Chenow fails to meet the threshold for clever. When it came to clever, Macy Manitou was all that. Probably even more so than Levi. I remember how once Uncle David asked me what the difference was between cleverness and intelligence. I'd figured out that a person could be intelligent without being clever, but not clever without also being intelligent. Cleverness also required a measure of shrewdness and creativity, neither of which were necessary to be intelligent. No doubt that Macy could ask a clever question, a bold question, a snarky question, if she wanted. But I'd been in a few classes with her, and she never raised her hand. If called upon, she would give the correct answer. Macy plays offense everywhere except the classroom. Question: could Macy Manitou be Lightbulb? Answer: no questions equals no Lightbulb. I think back to Travis asking endless questions, even in middle school. He would jabber nonstop the entire time we walked over to the high school for chemistry. Sometimes he and Levi would get into deep discussions, just with one or the other starting off with, "Riddle me this." Travis was in every AP class with me until he started skipping and then dropped out our last semester before graduation. Travis made classes fun. Even when Mike or Levi or any of my brother's friends were in an AP class with me, Travis was always the one I sat next to. He was intelligent as well as clever, and he asked smart questions. I can't imagine the brilliant and smiling Lightbulb as anyone but Travis Flint. A month later, around Thanksgiving break, Uncle David wrote down verbatim a question from Lightbulb. If a poisonous plant got tossed into compost, would it poison the whole batch of compost? Would it kill crops grown with the compost, or could the crops survive the poison? If they did survive, would poison remain in their roots or leaves? I stretch my legs while mulling over what I've read so far. Was Lightbulb's question actually about the origin of Meth X? I do a set of deep lunges from the library to the kitchen and return with a bottled water from the refrigerator. Was that when it all started? With a precocious student's inquiry? When I resume reading the notebook, I sit on the edge of the seat. My legs bounce with jittery tension as the entry dates approach the holiday break. In early December, Uncle David tried helping Lightbulb develop a research methodology for testing plant toxicity and its spread into surrounding organic material. Lightbulb became impatient. Instead of a carefully thought-out plan with sequenced steps, Lightbulb wanted to jump ahead. Soon after, the daily entries mentioning Lightbulb were crossed out, and a comment added in the margin each time: no show. I recall multiple instances of Travis skipping class, only to show up the following day and ace an unannounced quiz. On December 8th, 2003, Uncle David wrote one word: champignons, the French word for mushrooms. Uncle David's entries from then on are in the code he and my mother invented. It takes longer to get through his notes because I need to translate. I'm used to hearing, rather than seeing, the hybrid of French, Italian, and quirky made-up words. One of the next entries references canard isola. Canard is the French word for duck. Isola is the Italian word for island. Canard isola means duck island. He doesn't abbreviate it as DI, instead he uses CI, which is confusing at first because I keep thinking it means confidential informant. It was in December that he must have picked up on Travis's increased drug use. He wrote in code about his growing concern that Lightbulb was messing around in things he shouldn't. That was around the time that I noticed Travis skipping school more and looking really out of it when he was in class. Lily and Travis began arguing, and not their normal cute spats, like whether Zamboni was a cooler name for a boy or a girl. Lily found out over winter break that Travis was cooking meth. She tried talking to Angie Flint about getting help for him. Lily fumed to me about moms who made excuses for their sons. It's so fucked up when a mom enables her boy instead of raising a man. I resume reading. In January, an entry mentions Chil Ege. I don't recognize it as any of Mom's and David's nonsense words. I try enunciating different parts of the word. Like when Lily would say Shag Allah instead of Sha Gala. Chil Ege. Chil Ege. Chi Legi. Chi Leg. Chi Lege. That's it. C-H-E-E is a phonetic way of spelling the Anishinaabe Mo'in word chi, big. Legge is Italian for law, big law. Chi Legge was David's word for the FBI.